is Hazel Kahn, and this is Tidings.
And today, my guest is Christina Nicol. She is a first-time author with a very strange and extraordinary book called Waiting for the Electricity. It's published by Overlook Press, and this year it's come out in paperback form. So welcome, Christina. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, thank you so much for talking to me.
I must confess, Christina, that until I read Waiting for the Electricity, I knew absolutely nothing about post-Soviet Georgia. And however well-educated our listeners are, I imagine that most of them will know a lot more after they listen to this interview than they did before.
One of my questions will be, is how fictional is it all? Because I'm also very curious about why you've been to these countries and why you settled on Georgia or in Georgia. I don't know how long you were there for.
Really, what started my fascination with these post-Soviet countries was as a kid during the 80s, during the Cold War, my grandfather had this organization called Promoting Enduring Peace that would bring 100 Americans and 100 Russians on this boat, and we would cruise up the Volga River, and every day stopping for these peace conferences in the towns. I mean, this was during Soviet times, and so the Soviet government had handpicked who we would be meeting, and they were these chess champions and cosmonauts and ballet dancers, and most of the Americans were peacenik senior citizens. But this experience, I really just fell in love with Russia. Here were these people who were supposed to be our enemies, and I developed all these friendships. And
so you were on the boat, in other words. You were one of the 100 people. How old were you at the time?
10.
Your child.
It was one of those peak experiences, left its imprint. Also, the Soviet Union had so much mythology around it, and there's something about falling in love with the enemy. It sort of extends the boundaries of what reality can be. When the Soviet Union collapsed, I was fascinated. Well, how are they transforming? You know, what are the tales that they're telling themselves? This new direction that they're going in. Every republic was telling itself a different story. I traveled to Kyrgyzstan, and they pretty much didn't even know that the Soviet Union had failed. I mean, they were still saluting Lenin. They believed in the ideals of communism, and they were pretty much untouched by some of the horrors of it. I became fascinated with how countries reinvent their own identities and how, reading this book, so it's been on my mind, this book about staying human in the age of big data. We have our own narrative, and it feels like a sort of inevitable narrative of this techno-capitalism. And in America, we think that it's sort of this narrative of the future, this inevitability. But the thing that struck me about Georgia so much was that they were incredibly creative in how they were redefining what their identity was. Namely, they were looking to the 12th century to find that identity, which is something that's sort of unheard of. They didn't really want much to do with the current kind of capitalist narrative, in that no one would even go to McDonald's. McDonald's probably spent more money hiring an architect to design a McDonald's that looked like some spectacular design just to get people to go.
They didn't go to McDonald's. Was it an act, a political act, or simply a cultural act?
First of all, they didn't like the food. They just weren't that interested in this American story. And so I was really fascinated with how a country is actually resisting that American story. I mean, of course, not everyone. I mean, of course, every country has as many stories as there are people. Mm. But my friends who I met were resisting that story. So I actually was trying to get back to Kyrgyzstan. So I had applied the Soros program, and they said, well, Kyrgyzstan's filled up, but you can go to Georgia, Armenia, or Mongolia, but you have to decide tomorrow. I knew nothing about Georgia, but I had seen some folk dancers, these sword dances, and these sparks would fly off their swords. So I just randomly chose it. So that's how I ended up there.
I'm just thinking, so you were 10, I don't know, thinking about this boat that you were on. I just need to understand that. How long was that trip up the Volga?
He did that trip pretty much every year, 1980 to 1989. And it was 10 days on the Volga and then another week or two in Moscow and Leningrad at the time, kind of just meeting with people trying to establish peace. Also at the time, there was this real sense of the old rules don't apply anymore because we're on the brink of destruction, you know, at the push of a button. Now, I mean, we're still on the brink of destruction with climate change, but it's not the push of a button. I think at that time there was this sense and a certain kind of freedom that the old rules of self-interest aren't effective anymore and we have to do something drastic to save the planet. That was sort of the feeling on these peace cruises, getting together and trying to figure out solutions.
How does that seem to you now? Does it seem very naive or innocent, or does it seem still feasible way to, I guess, make a difference?
You know, I mean, as a kid, I was pretty idealistic. I mean, I was much more idealistic. I still think that kind of people-to-people diplomacy is really crucial. I mean, just finding the humanity. I mean, I wish that they had those types of peace cruises going on in the Middle East right now. Just getting to know each other on a human level does amazing things.
To some extent, I suppose social media can create that in a sort of intangible way.
Yeah, I think it does. People are, you know, constantly posting these beautiful videos of people in other countries. Yeah, it's true. It's true. These heart-lifting images.
Citizen journalists and all that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Let me ask you, did those 9 years, basically, right, or 8 years of peace cruises, was it always the same people or different people each time?
Oh, different people each time. It really changed their lives as well. I think less so the Russians, in a sense, because the Americans, they were really convinced that we were on the brink of disaster. The Russians pretty much said, well, that would be idiotic. They're not actually going to push the button. Mm. They weren't as fearful about it. I mean, I think they were just more interested in meeting Americans. And I love their own idealism. I mean, for all of communism's horrible things, the idea that you could actually be striving for this sense of greater good was a really powerful thing to physically experience. To live in a place where there are absolutely no advertisements. I mean, the only billboards you would see would be peace doves, you know, and that right now that's just images of science fiction. But to actually see that, what it's like to live in a place where there's not this barrage of advertising constantly, it was powerful.
I'm also very curious about where you come from.
I grew up north of San Francisco in a pretty rural area. I spent a lot of time wandering through the forest, and I actually found a pair of Russian binoculars in the forest as a kid. And so my parents were sort of scared of, you know, were we being spied on or something for these trips we were taking. I went to the University of Oregon and studied Russian. Then I ended up getting my MFA at University of Florida.
You learned Russian then quite early on.
Yeah, I've kind of lost it at this point, but yeah, survival Russian.
You're also teaching English, your biography says, in these different countries.
Primarily in these post-Soviet countries, but I did teach some in India and some in South Korea. Really, it was a way to live in another culture and to hear people's stories. At this point, I sort of hate being a tourist because it feels too alienating after having had this experience of actually participating, which is a much richer experience. I was in India for 6 months and in South Korea for a couple of years. I taught in Kazakhstan a couple of years ago and Kosovo last year. In some ways, it's easier now to, you know, there's Skype and there's 200 movies on your computer. When I lived in Georgia, since there wasn't any electricity, I became a little bit more dependent on the culture for my emotional support. And now the impact is a little bit less. because with all of this computer access, you have these emotional supports that aren't necessarily of the culture.
Yeah, they've been globalized.
Right.
I was thinking as you said that in the old days, the story, the narrative of white people or rich people or more advanced people going into other countries, in that narrative, people are somehow doing a favor to the country they're visiting. They're helping them, like missionaries. One is going to these countries and bringing them enlightenment. That's one narrative.
Right.
But now the traveler, to the extent that I can call oneself a traveler anymore, is the one who's getting, as you said, I would be the one getting much more out of the deal than the people I'm visiting because they've already seen where I come from. But I haven't seen where they come from. So I'm getting more out of the transaction, if you will. Do you see what I'm saying?
Exactly. Because I would feel conflicted. I would feel like, you know, what am I doing teaching them English? You know, so many people come to America, and yet how many people are actually going to another culture in order to learn more about them? Yeah, definitely. I learned much more from them than I'm sure they learned from me.
Author Christina Nicol is talking about her novel, Waiting for the Electricity, first published in 2014 by Overlook Press and published in paperback this year. This is Hazel Kahn and Tidings on WPKN Radio.
So let's talk about your book. Your learning is certainly in that book. Can you talk about how you decided to write your book?
I actually started writing it when I came back from Georgia. And I was having such a culture shock that I really missed the people from Georgia. And this line just came to my head of, my name is Slims Ahmed and I live in the 12th century. And as soon as I had that line, his voice just came out of me. Basically, this character just sort of lived inside of me and was making these comments about American society and was sort of helping me adjust back to my own culture. Just because Georgia is this very strange place, it doesn't conform to the rules we think would create a functional society. I mean, partly because they value art and poetry more than money, which causes a certain amount of dysfunction. I mean, things don't really function that well because they're all these romantic artists, but creates this passion that I just hadn't encountered before, and kind of like living in some sort of Shakespearean play. It's true that a lot of people read it and think of this novel as this absurdist literature because it's in the tradition of the carnivalesque, of turning reality upside down and turning your suffering upside down as a way to cope with difficulty. But I did have people write to me who'd actually lived in Georgia and they said, oh, this is the most realistic novel I've ever read. You know, it captures the place exactly. When I first wrote it, I mean, I didn't even think more than 7 people would read it because it was so much my own love song to Georgia. But it did start resonating with American readers because we see ourselves in a sort of relief of Georgia, of this sort of upside down land where perhaps these things that we, or that at least I long for in my soul of connection and community, are manifest in this culture. It was, how can I depict this in a novel?
His name is Slims Ahmed Makashvili.
Right. You said it better than anyone ever has.
After I finished the book and I had arranged to interview you, I almost imagined that you would speak that way when we started talking to each other on Skype. I really imagined you must speak like that. That's how strongly you have depicted this character. And he is such an interesting character. I mean, he's so complex. I our listeners to get some idea of who he is and how he reflects that aspect of Georgian culture. I mean, he's very much this feeling of protective of the past, right, of ancient Georgian heritage. And somewhere either you or a critic wrote, but even the power outages lend a special calmness to the country, a kind of mortal rapture, the fullness of being, knowing that the next moment everything could stop working.
Right.
So the idea of the electricity, or the absence of electricity, being a very large part of the definition of the culture. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. People's days were organized around that hour of electricity, and no one knew when that hour would come. And so it felt Kafkaesque because your mind was always thinking about that hour. And so you had to leave your tap open to make sure, because that was the only time you would get water. They were already a developed country, so it wasn't people were accustomed to going to the well and getting their water.
I didn't realize they were going back in time rather than just standing still.
Right. They were really proud of the fact that they were the richest republic of the Soviet Union. They had gotten used to all of these modern conveniences. And that passage you read is really a crucial part of it. I grew up with a dad who had read pretty much every book on global warming and would give us daily lectures and pretty much freak out our friends. And, you know, if my brother would go to a baseball game, he'd say, oh, you better enjoy it now. There's not going to be any baseball in the future. So there was this, would the planet still be here when I grew up? But how do people deal with that? So here was this country of Georgia who's had to actually face that. And what does that do to the psyche? And how do people recover from that? I think a lot about this, about people who've lost their lives in the tsunami or in Katrina. Are we a society that would come together like they do in Georgia, of everyone helping, you know, their neighbors? I mean, is that a natural inclination that happens in disaster? Or do you have to work on those cultural muscles? Mm-hmm. So, you know, Georgia was a country where people did come together. It's a very religious country as well. And I would ask them, well, what does the priest say in church? Does he tell you to help your neighbors? They would just say, what? Why would we need the priest to tell us that?
There's one part where towards the end of the book in that forest where the priest was there, somebody says to somebody else, well, you know, he stole this. Should you call the police? And they said, well, he wouldn't steal it if he didn't need it.
Right.
You know, it's very touching, actually, all of that, I found. Talking more about Slims, can you describe him a little bit more? I think you would do it better than I would.
He's the eternal optimist. His country is run by bandits and there's no electricity and no one can get a job. And yet he has this eternal hopefulness and this kind of faith in humanity. And he has a faith in America that, you know, America must just be like Georgia. They just have the light on and they follow the law. So all I have to do is go study in America and figure out how they get people to follow the law and bring it back here. And we can be a dignified people. But then he comes to the U.S. and is confused that the U.S. isn't quite like America, that people are isolated. He's never had the experience of being isolated before. I mean, that's not even a concept that he's familiar with. And so he's just confounded, but consistently, hopefully confounded. And he has this belief system that there's something malevolent about our habit of thinking one thing and speaking another and doing another. He's really a man of his honor in a picaresque kind of a way, where he really feels there shouldn't be this disjoint between what he's thinking and what he says. And so much Western literature is based on that, the public life versus our secret private inner life. And so I was trying to create a character where the public life and the internal life were actually in alignment because this guy was so committed to his community.
Is the culture like that?
That was how I saw it. I mean, of course, everyone has their internal private life and their public life. I mean, but I definitely saw a much stronger commitment to the public life than I tend to see here. But that was with an outsider's eyes. But then he finds that he's stuck inside two different cultures, which I think is this dilemma that most people experience when they've lived abroad, seeing your own culture with different eyes and you don't quite fit in the same way you used to, but you don't really quite fit into the other. He's living in a kind of in-between state. And so he wants to change things, but he also realizes the odds against him, the forces of globalization with these oil pipelines. And so trying to keep a sense of humor, which is how Georgians refined this sense of humor to be able to deal with these odds that are so difficult. It's also a very fatalistic place with orthodoxy. So there is a sense of giving up one's own will to a higher will of God. There's not that same kind of ambition. I mean, ambition in some ways is considered a bad word. But it also, I don't know, there's something about that that alleviates stress in a place where people don't have a lot of control of their fate.
Right, but then because of globalization, the culture is starting to change. Saakashvili was the president then, right? Mm-hmm. At the time you write, and he was trying to modernize and change things. Is that right?
In the US, we do have these rules, and in a sense, if we follow the rules, things work out for us. You know, you stop at the stoplight and it maintains somewhat a sense of order, at least more of a sense of order than Georgia had at the time. Now they do stop at stoplights and wear seatbelts. But at the time, there was this Wild West quality and a kind of romanticism about it. It was sort of like, well, we don't follow external laws. We follow the law of the heart. And our heart laws are more developed. We have to decide what's the moral thing to do at the last minute. We don't have external laws to rely on and to make us lazy. That was the theme that I was trying to work with.
But again, globalization and Slim's perceptions and experience from his trip to San Francisco start to make a dent in that romantic Wild West narrative.
Right.
But what I found, again, very compelling, was that they experience it as a loss. There is somewhere somebody says, we've lost the act of waiting. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that, writing that?
Mm-hmm.
And just generally, there is a sense of loss when they're losing what they thought was wonderful about their culture.
I would always ask Georgians, why are you so proud of your history? Because they all are. They all know their history so deeply. And one Georgian said, well, it's the only thing we have. They've already had a huge loss. And so there's a sense that if their identity is crushed, what else will they have? I mean, they are modernizing, maybe benefit from that in some way. But from what I hear from people I've talked to, it's a mixed bag. They want things to function more. They're very tied to the land for thousands of years. So here they have this president saying, oh, well, you know, we need to turn our country into a tourist country. That's where we can get our money. And let's not focus on our vegetables. We can just buy all of our vegetables from Turkey. Let's just build tourist attractions.
And let's dilute our wine so it'll be more palatable to the Westerner.
Right.
To the tourist. Yeah, that was kind of wrenching, you know. And the other thing that we haven't mentioned, the way they get their gasoline is by sort of siphoning from this oil pipeline, and they don't really see what's wrong with it. And then this Englishman comes around, and his job is to seal up the holes in the pipeline so they can't siphon it off anymore. Is that actually a real thing that happened?
Yeah, I met the man who I based the English guy on. I met him and he was describing that problem. I mean, that was something that he had to do. He said, we offered them money, you know, for every hole that they found, and then we found them drilling new ones. Mm. I met him on the plane going back to the U.S. where we sat next to each other. It was just from that airplane ride, actually, that this whole character was created.
The culture clash is all the way through the book.
Yeah, that just obsesses me, is that place where cultures collide. Because I don't know, there's something in that sparking, it's that third option, I guess, that reveals a different possibility than the way that we think of as reality. It's extending our borders, I guess.
I understand I understand what you're saying. But also there's the tension between the present and the past. There's also that cultural clash, the Soviet and post-Soviet realities.
The whole Soviet Union is so much about nostalgia. I mean, they call it a kind of imperialistic nostalgia, that they have greater attributes for containing this nostalgia than anybody else.
I think it was a critic who said that you described a country that nobody really would want to go to. And my thing was, absolutely not true. I really now want to go to this country because I see it as a place where there is vitality, food and music and singing and these poems. Did you translate those poems or the songs?
I translated them, yeah. With the help of my friends, but usually it was in a somewhat inebriated state, so I could attest to their accuracy.
And these proverbs, and just generally, they're always sort of talking these highfalutin ways. And I just think it'd be a very interesting country to visit. But I don't know if it's still like that, because the essential thing, as it's, you know, the title of your book, Waiting for the Electricity. Now they've got electricity. So now it's a post-electricity society.
Well, I went back 2 years ago, and I was scared that it would have lost those things that I loved about it, but it was pretty much exactly the same. I mean, people still yelled on the street. It is changing a little bit. I mean, people are becoming more ambitious, definitely. But there's that love of the artistic sentiment and this very romantic sense, and there's still the love for the land. I actually had a friend who went recently, and he's traveled all throughout Russia. He said that anytime he's been in Russia, often people will say to him, "Why are you here? What is here for you?" And when he got to Georgia, he said that was the first thing that struck him, is that no one asked him, why would you come here? They just assume, well, why wouldn't you come here? Yeah. We have the best food and wine.
There is that. And it's the idea, which may have come from the electricity thing or not. I mean, I've lived in countries, too, where the government really messed around with electricity. So I understand how that is. When there's no electricity, then people can't really do anything. They can't move around. And so they sit around and they talk. I get the feeling that in Georgia, everybody's always talking to each other.
Yeah.
That there's no rush to go and, as you say, be ambitious, even though that may be changing.
Right. And I think that's what I so loved about it, was that sense of presence that people had with each other. They had really mastered the art of conversation.
Exactly. I just love this book. So I'm really glad to have read it, but why don't we end with you telling our listeners how they can get in touch with you and your book or anything else that you'd like to tell them? Maybe what future plans you have as well.
The book's available at Overlook. I think it should be available at most stores. There's a Facebook page if they Google Waiting for the Electricity. I have a website that I haven't really updated in a while, christinanicol.com.
And that's N-I-C-H-O-L.
That's right.
Are there any plans for future things? Are you going to write a book for each of those narratives of all those post-Soviet states, republics?
I have three projects that I'm working on. One is about Korea. It's about teaching English to these Buddhist monks. So it's called Women Who Love Monks Too Much. I'm working on a novel set in both Canada and India, and a collection of essays about Kosovo, about going back and forth between the Albanian and the Serbian worldview and trying to reconcile those, not very successfully. I can't seem to quite be able to write about America at this point.
I can understand that. And besides, everybody else is writing about America.
I know, there's so many.
The most self-reflective country in the world. So thank you very much, Christina Nicol.
Well, thank you so much for talking about this.
I just found it really interesting, and I definitely think people should read this book. And I just know stuff I didn't know before. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Christina Nicol, talking about her novel Waiting for the Electricity, first published in 2014 by Overlook Press and published as paperback this year. You can listen to Tidings on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. Tidings is archived on hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.